64.
Good morning, welcome to the edition of Senate Revenue Committee. Today we have three bills on our agenda, Senate Bill 764, Senate Bill 260, and Senate Bill 933. The chair will begin with Senate Bill 933, and I believe we can do that in record time this morning. Morning, Mr. Yates.
Good morning, Chair.
Could you refresh the memory of the committee about what is the purpose of Senate Bill 933?
Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. There exists already in current law authority for intergovernmental agreements which create intergovernmental entities. And what this bill does is to give certain additional powers to those types of entities, intergovernmental entities, that operate, maintain, repair, and modernize roads. There's an amendment before you as well, 933, which simply substitutes for the word roads transportation facilities. So that would broaden somewhat the purposes for which these districts could spend money. An intergovernmental entity which is organized for this purpose then has the power to issue general obligation bonds and to levy taxes and fees for the payment of debt service. It limits outstanding bonds to 2% of the real market value of taxable property within the entity and allows the electors in these entities to establish a permanent tax rate for property tax purposes, so they can also raise revenue for current purposes as well as bonding. Grants entity the powers necessary to carry out the purposes of the agreement. For counties, it requires that when they enter into such agreements, say with other counties, that they consult with the governing bodies of the cities within the county. So they have to have agreement essentially of the cities within the county when they come to one of these intergovernmental agreements. It excludes these entities from the definition of a district and exempts them from the requirements of county service districts. That's basically what it does.
Sounds hopelessly Pollyanna to me, Mr. Yates. But let's hear about this from Bill Tenhollow and Judge Laura Pryor, please.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Laura Pryor, and I'm the county judge from Gillum County. I'm going to ask you to think back to Senate Bill 1145 some years ago that allowed counties to join together, cross boundaries for bonding to build jails. That was the model that we were hoping to use here. And let me speak to Eastern Oregon and the rural counties where I come from. We haven't had an increase in transportation funding now for 10 years, and we are not likely to have any for the foreseeable future. The counties out there, the four counties that built the regional jail, Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, and Wheeler, went together to build that jail. We are finding ourselves now in the situation as many other counties, I'll use us as the example, having to do something with our roads and not having the way to do it. Because of a few low population base, we're going to have to aggregate our needs, and we're going to have to aggregate our ability to fund. So as we were searching for some tool that we might ask to have created to help us do that, we thought about the success that we had had putting four counties together to build the rural jail. And the more we looked at that, the more we thought this probably is a good model for us. Because in order to build, to get the bonding for that regional four-county jail with 16 cities, we had to do a lot of work up front, on the front end of it, with the cities to find out what their needs were to go into the process of building a jail in the first place. That's the same kind of thing I think we have to do here. City streets have to be taken into consideration in any of these processes that we put together to deal with our needs out there for streets, roads, and highways. Now, ODOT's in the same boat we are in our region, and we may need to be able to bond the counties money and match it at some point with some ODOT money, even to do an ODOT road that comes across and meets our market roads. So if we could have this flexible tool to be able to address those transportation needs out there, basically to get our products to market, it would be very helpful. Now, at the Association of Marion Counties board meetings, we've discussed this, whether or not this, we started out thinking that maybe this was just something that was needed in Eastern Oregon, and we found out that indeed it is not. Even the metropolitan area is looking at this and thinking that it's a very good tool for them as well. So although I'm the only one here today testifying on this, I can tell you that in the discussions we've had both at the full board meeting of AOC with all 36 counties and at the Transportation Committee meeting, where we have representation of the metropolitan counties as well as the rural counties, that this is a tool that would be very helpful for all of us to have. We've had conversations with ODOT about this. We've had conversations with ODOT about this out at the county and district level of ODOT, and it would be very helpful. Let me just quickly give you another example. Again, it's an example from rural Oregon. There's a need for ODOT to have rock. There's a crushed rock. There's a need for the counties to have crushed rock. Four of our little counties have to try to get the mobile crushers to come in, and they aren't always successful because when ODOT's got a big job going or there's a big job going in Bend, you can't get them. But we might be able to aggregate that, get enough money where we could crush rock for 4 or 5 years for all of us. So that's another way you could use this tool if we could get it.
In the simplest terms, the bill before us would allow the counties to join with other counties and other entities for the purpose of bonding on a local levy for the production of roads, is where the bill reads currently. I understand there's been some discussion of adding the word transportation facilities and deleting the word roads, and that would give even more flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
But colleagues, in just general terms, this bill has been heard by the General Government Transportation Committee, sent out with a do-pass recommendation. It's been heard by our committee. Issue that was a sticking point last time was the inability to include other transportation services besides roads. So there is an amendment that we're going to be looking at this morning. Have you seen the amendment, ma'am?
I have not.
Okay. Perhaps we can have staff transmit the amendment. Basically, the substituted transportation facility for the word roads. And, of course, the county would have to disclose what those transportation facilities are before the levies were offered to the community or the intergovernmental entity offered the election. So I'm hoping that amendment is not fatal. Senator Byer, you have a question.
A quick one. I'm curious. I think this is fine. I'm just curious, why not do a special district?
The answer that I could give you to that, what we have found is there's a real aversion to creating more districts, but there's not much of an aversion for the people, from the citizens, something that's really targeted to a project and a product where they can see the outcome of it. My own personal feeling is that they think that's too broad. They really don't want to do another district.
I imagine special districts always have a certain amount of superstructure and special reporting requirements and audit requirements. Anything we can do to keep those pesky auditors out of the county is a good thing, as far as I'm concerned.
Looks like a duck.
Mr. Penhall, do you have anything to add to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, Bill Penhall, for the record, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. Number one, let me go on record indicating, as Judge Pryor has, AOC supports Senate Bill 933, and I would just add, this becomes another tool that counties consider, in addition to the special district authority that we have and road district authorities that we have in the existing statutes.
Thank you, Mr. Penhall. Any questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair.
Ma'am.
I don't have a question. I guess just a comment that, I mean, I'm supportive of this bill. I just think it's too bad that local governments are, you know, forced to try to find all these different creative ways to deal with your transportation needs because of the failure of the legislature to step forward and take care of our transportation system and come up with a package that delivers good services for our state. And I just think it's really unfortunate, and I think I wish that the legislature could get its act together and really put together a very helpful transportation package that could address the needs of our state. So I just want to just say that because I know for local governments, you're wishing that we would get our act together as well on that issue.
Senator Castillo, I am willing to take personal responsibility for not having a consent to get that increase in each of two legislative sessions. And I don't know about the local elections that happened across the state. That kind of went down, too. But,
well, it
Senator,
there were
you know,
other reasons for it.
No, I did it personally, actually.
just a little, I can't let pass without commenting. What about the legislature? As I recall, the legislature did pass a major bill last session. Unfortunately, the people didn't choose to like it.
Well, okay. Never mind.
20% of them.
And some of my colleagues.
The final comment is, never mind.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to point out we didn't raise that issue.
The history of the issue and Judge Breyer are intertwined. At least it's been in my experience.
Laura's been doing roads for as long as I can remember.
Senator.
If I could share, the reason this bill was such a good bill is because it reflects, I think, the polling that was done that provided information to something last year called the Bi-State Transportation Finance Meeting that was held in Beaverton. And the interesting thing that they pointed out was, first of all, you've got to build projects people want. You've got to build them on time. You've got to build them, with existing budgets. But there was a real point, too, and that is there has to be believability. You guys are trying to target and say, we're going to do this. We'll deliver that for you. Mm-hmm. And we did that about 15 years ago in Yamhill County. We went out and actually sold a $10 million road levy because we said, this is exactly what we're going to do. And then we just methodically tried to deliver that. Well, the point of it is that right now nobody believes we're going to deliver projects. And there is why this bill is so important. Once it may be a little bitty baby step towards building back that credibility. But if you give us money, we will build things for you.
Senator George, I think that is right on target. The other thing I envision as a result of this bill is that it changes the equation by putting the county in the contracting role. And I just would be kind of amused to watch the contractor for the road construction project in Judge Pryor's county trying to explain the change order or the delay. Yeah, I think that'll be an interesting conversation. So.
Senator, I'd like to see a project. We haven't had one in 27 years. I would like to see one. I'd argue with anybody that would do a change order.
Well, let's move forward. There's another person who has signed up to testify on this bill. Mr. Brostoff from Thousand Friends of Oregon would like to come and talk to the bill.
Was Judge Pryor able to explain the difference between the lower and the upper, John Day?
I'm not sure we ever asked the question, and I'm not sure the chair would like to ask the question.
Never mind.
Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Farrelly, members of the committee. My testimony is coming around, and I'm so used to seeing Senator George in a different committee that I forgot to change the header on it, but I know that I'm talking to the Revenue Committee, and that's who the testimony is intended for. Accidentally still says a different committee up top, but it's really meant for you. So.
You're just supporting recycling.
That's exactly right. That's right. Low-impact lobbying. That's what we're all about at 1,000 Friends. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before the committee today on Senate Bill 933 with some amendments. We support the legislature's efforts and Judge Pryor's efforts and local efforts to develop innovative funding mechanisms for Oregon's transportation system and its transportation needs. At the first hearing on this bill, we expressed some concern that it only enabled local governments to fund road projects, and we've since proposed amendments that would broaden the scope of this bill to enable local governments to fund all different kinds of transportation facilities. I want to be really clear that these amendments do not prescribe particular kinds of transportation investments, so they don't require local governments to invest in any one kind of transportation. They merely enable them. They have given them the flexibility if the local government chooses to invest in elements of the transportation system in addition to roads. So this is really about providing more flexibility for local governments. I really appreciated Judge Pryor's comments about the diversity of needs of transportation system needs across the state, and we feel that this bill with our amendments would really help local governments address those different needs in different parts of the state. And we'd like to see this bill go forward. We think this is a great bill with the amendments that we're proposing, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you all might have.
Questions? Hearing and seeing none. We are in work session. The chairman will entertain a motion to add the Dash 1 amendments.
So moved.
So moved. The Dash 1 amendments have been moved by the vice chair. Any questions on the motion? Any objections to the motion? So ordered. Colleagues, the chair will entertain a motion to move Senate Bill 933 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Vice Chair?
Move Senate Bill 933 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Vice Chair moves Senate Bill 933 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions on the motion? Any objections to the motion? So ordered. Chair will carry. Close the work session on Senate Bill 933. Excuse me. We will move to the Senate Bill 260.
And I should move out.
Good morning.
Good morning. What would you like to proceed with?
Well, I think what we need to do is talk about where we have been and then discuss the issue of the run and the modifications to the formula, ask for feedback with invited testimony. Senator Minna.
Could we just talk about the amendments?
Sure. We can do that.
Because I think we're going to have to choke on these things and move it.
Actually, we may choke harder than that. But let's talk about the amendments, Steve.
Yeah.
When last we met, we were going to do some formulaic adjustments, and let's just talk about how those things shook out.
And Mr. Chair, then if you like, I can walk through the amendments fairly quickly, section by section, so that you know exactly what's in the amendments and what's reflected in the numbers from those amendments. So if you look at Senate Bill 260-3 amendments that you have as part of your packet this morning, you'll see that it begins off or starting out with some whereas clauses that states what the assembly recognizes and what the intent is. Specifically, the last one says that the intent is that there will be full equity of funding within 4 years. Then it goes on in sections two, starting with some definitions that are defined later in the bill. If you go to section three, that's the beginning of the calculation process for the year 2001-2002. It defines the base amount being the higher of the dollars received in the prior year or the dollars per student times the current year students, if that's a higher number. So it's the higher of those two. Same thing on the top of page three, you have that base amount defined for the second year of the biennium, 0203. Again, the same conditions, total dollars or dollars per student. Then at about line 17, you have the 2% adjustment if the education service district has more than 2,500 students and has a base amount that is above the target amount. Then in section 4, it defines the target amount. It starts out with a calculation where all of the state school fund dollars, the local dollars for both K-12 and ESD, are run through the school formula and distributed on a per district basis. And then the target amount is set at 5% of that distribution to the component districts within the ESD. So it's basically using the school equalization formula, running all the money through it to the districts, and then finding out what the district total is for the ESD and taking 5% of it as the target. And it makes it real clear that this calculation in line 16, sub 2, does not apply to the K-12 distribution. So it's a separate use of the school equalization formula. Section 5 in line 19 defines the revenue gap as the target amount less or minus the base amount, but it cannot be less than zero. Section 6 defines the grant itself and the process of balancing what the per student or dollar amounts would be for all of the districts to the final dollars that would be available. Sub 2 in line 30 at the bottom of page 4 defines that grant for 01-02. And then at the top of page 5, sub 3, defines the grant for 02-03. In the first year, the district receives the base amount plus 19.55% of any revenue gap that it has that's above zero, or the minimum of $750,000 if that's more. And then that amount is taken times the funding percentage to balance to the funds available. And then the state school fund grant is that amount less local EBSD local revenues. So it's that process that's gone through to calculate the grant. And the second year is 17% of the revenue gap, as in line 5. And then the other sections, beginning in line 7 on page 5, deal with boundary changes and administrative procedures that were the administrative procedures at least were the same as in 1999, but as adopted in 1999, they were temporary, so they need to be repeated again to continue them. Section 7 at the bottom of page 5 is the repeal in June 30th, 2003, so these changes only apply to the 01-03 biennium. At the top of page 6, section 9, you have the 90% of the revenues expended from the state school fund and local revenue to be by the resolution process involving two-thirds of the districts with at least a majority of the students. And that would begin in the second year of the biennium in 02-03, according to Section 10. Then it goes into the competitive bid services. If you'll turn to page 7, it has provisions that require competitive bidding for ESDs that have more than 20,000 weighted students. That applies to eight ESDs. It would meet that criteria where they have to have competitive bidding for contracts entered into with another education service district or with a school district. So it adds that component in addition to all of the competitive bidding provisions that are in ORS 279. And then it would have to disclose criteria for awarding the contract if requested. Section 13 has the same language that applies to K-12 school districts for competitive bidding. The 20,000 or more ADMW extended there would apply to the 5 largest school districts in the state. It was 8 ESDs, 5 school districts. It would be subject to the criteria. Then on page 8, it deals with the interim task force. This pretty much follows the pattern of the 1999 ESD Interim Task Force in terms of members, 17 members appointed by various people. Sub 3 on line 27 indicates that there has to be a balance of representation from the various regions of the state. At the top of page 9, it lists the duties of the task force in terms of definitions of services, catalog of services offered by ESDs, correlation of services to each set of accounts, and identified deficiencies. Sub 6 are reports to the Interim Revenue Committee and final report. Sub 7 deals with member expenses reimbursement. Sub 8 is staffing by the Department of Education. 9 is the majority vote requirement for the task force recommendations. And finally, section 16 on page 10 has an effective date of July 1, 2001.
Colleagues, the virtually all the sections of the bill that are represented in dash 3 come directly from the recommendations of the task force or discussions from this committee or additions and concerns of individual members. The issue, I believe, that is yet to be resolved is actually the distribution funding formula. The actual runs are available. I guess we'll just have those distributed at this point, and then we'll ask for feedback since some of these runs were released yesterday evening. So we do have some feedback.
Yes, they are part of your packet. I believe they're underneath the amendments. They should be available to others. They were in the office yesterday. And you have two tables, a simulation 4-1 for the first year, 2001-2, and 4-2 for estimates for the second year.
Questions? I'd like to call Mr. Marshall forward.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Which is the run that...
Mr. Gamble may, absolutely.
Which is the run that's the last suggested by the COSA?
Well, actually,
I don't think there is.
There hasn't been one. I think COSA's been involved in helping to tailor these amendments, and I think they have some feedback that would bring us forward to another position, but let's talk about this.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. My, oh, my. First of all, I'd like to give some credit to Senator Farioli, as well as all members of the committee, for your patience and diligence in dealing with an extremely contentious issue. What we're trying to do is balance out the interests of 21 education service districts. This is really not much different than a decade ago when we undertook equalization of school districts and trying to balance out what was then the interest of 300-plus school districts. My interest is to try to represent the interests of all 21 ESDs, and that is, to say the least, extremely difficult. What you have is a circumstance where there are broad and significant disparities in terms of the dollars that are allocated to each of the 21 ESDs, which I believe and we believe has a direct impact on the services that are provided to students in those ESD's constituent school districts. It would be simple, fast, and relatively easy to approach equalization in one fell swoop. That is to look at the average and to bring all those ESDs above the average down, and on the other hand, bring all those ESDs under the average up. That, of course, is not possible. I don't think it's realistic from a policy perspective, and it's certainly not possible from a political one. So the charge that we have is how can we move towards equalization while recognizing that you don't want to do extreme damage to the high-resource ESDs, but that those ESDs below the average have a case to make in terms of the equity of services and the equity of resources to provide students to their constituent school district. The task force that met over the last year suggested that to equalize, it should be done in a four-year period, and that you start off the first year by moving 25% of the way, the second year a third of the way, the third year half of the way, and finally in the fourth year you achieve full equalization. I think there a case has been made that that pathway is too fast, that it does too much damage to some high-resource ESDs that are providing services in a totally different environment that many of us are used to. That is, there are great distances, a lot of windshield time, and a lot of special needs students that aren't close to the office where those services are provided. It would seem that a rational approach would be to construct a plan where the folks on the bottom see that there is movement towards equalization, while the folks at the top realize that there's a movement towards equalization. It's our view, and I think the view of the majority of education service districts, that in order to do that, there has to be some reduction for all ESDs above the mean, and that the dollars that result from that reduction from all ESDs above the mean be channeled towards those ESDs below the mean in a way to bring those that are furthest from the average up to a greater extent than those closer to the average. The proposal you have before you creates protections for the smaller ESDs that are high resource. One of the proposals is to take a look at services that are provided by ESDs and come up with some rational basis for determining what an appropriate floor is for those primarily small, rural, and remote, isolated, whatever you want to call them, ESDs. We believe that that study ought to occur in advance of creating any kind of special protection. In discussions with some ESDs, there appears to be consensus that the reduction on the top, rather than the 2% that's proposed, could be as high as 3%. There was some discussion of anywhere from 3 to 5, but I think those higher resource ESDs believe that 5 is too much. And so we would suggest that you look at reducing by 3% all ESDs above the mean, take those dollars and move them around so that those ESDs below the mean are moved up. And again, those ESDs that whose resources are furthest from the target, that is the what we'll call the permanent formula, the 95-5, receive the greatest percentage increase. That's not to suggest that, that particular proposal will meet with 100% agreement by all 21 ESDs. But I believe it represents a rational compromise and sets up for this interim a rational study of services. And that would give us the opportunity to bring back to you in 2 years a view of what the minimum amount of services and resources ought to be for those small ESDs that are in particular circumstances. But we believe it would be premature to create protections for those small ESDs until there is a more thorough analysis of the kinds of services they're providing, the kinds of services they ought to be providing, and the resources necessary to provide for an effective and efficient delivery of those services. Again, Mr. Chairman, we're close. We're closer than we were yesterday, but in our view, not as close as we could possibly be tomorrow with the adjustments that I've described.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, John, let me see if I can play this back and understand it. The proposal that the chair has put on the table, generally you're favorable to the structure. You think the 2% should be 3%, and it sounds like, I'm not sure I heard you say this, but that no one above the mean should be held harmless, that if they're above the mean, they should take at least a 3% cut.
That's, I think, the consensus of the ESD organization, yes.
3% a year until we hit equalization?
It's not an accumulative thing, Senator Beyer. What it does is the 3% would be distributed throughout the formula for the 2-year period. So we're looking at a biennial 3%, not a 3-and-3.
Can you talk?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Revenue Committee, my name is David Campbell. I'm superintendent at Clackamas Education Service District, and obviously the comments I'm going to make have not been rehearsed to anyone. Yes.
Let me interrupt you for just a second. The chairman was wrong. It is a 2% and 2% in the current bill. So if we went to 3%, it would be a cumulative 6 on the base. Thank you.
Thank you. That's okay. If you will think back to the original information that I provided you that showed that under the original four-year plan that the first year the difference between base and target was going to come down by 25%, and the ones down lower were coming up by 25%. One thing we might want to consider would be to stay within that framework and change the 25% number coming down to some other number, say 10%, or, and then if you want to put a cap on how much effect on the base, we can do that. But the reason I'm suggesting that is because if you apply a straight 3% across an ESD that's very close to the target but barely above it right now, will in some cases actually push themselves below the target by a 3% reduction if you apply it across the board. And the percentage of change then is not applied in terms of how much higher they are from the target. If you go back to a percentage of the difference, then the mathematics play out, and what you really accomplish is further away you are, the higher you are, the more actual reduction you incur to move toward the target. Just as on the bottom side, the further away you are, the more increase you get to go toward the target. And so it would stay mathematically consistent on the top and the bottom, even though the percentages would be different.
Mr. Campbell, you were an educator. and before you went into administration, what was your specialty?
Mathematics.
Yeah.
That would be a dumb mistake.
Just speaking as an English major, I had a suspicion that, that might be what it was.
But if I might also add, I also taught English, so I had an interesting combination. Let me see if I can make it clear. There are a certain number of...
Contrast it with the difference of what John was talking about.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we have a contrast and comparison of the...
Yes. You go a straight 3% on the base. Some ESDs that are closer to the target actually are over-reduced. The 3% is too much. If you go with a percentage of the difference between target and the base and limit it, you have the further away they are, the higher they are from the target, the greater the reduction. That's basically what I'm suggesting. And it,
what you're proposing is a differential, a sort of a differential equation that closes as you get to the middle.
Correct.
See, I was an English major.
But you do understand different
ways. Actually, what you've done, Mr. Campbell, without realizing, is you've made a very strong case for Senate Bill 61, which was an adjustment that we looked at in the same way. It's how long have you been down and how far down did you go?
Yes.
In terms of loss of ADMW. That formula is one that would also need, I mean, it does automatically adjust, and the 3% does not automatically adjust.
That's correct.
So I think that's what you're bringing to the committee in this instance. Let's just leave that on the table for now. The question of mechanism of adjustment can certainly be discussed. Let me ask if the panel has any questions at this point. I'll ask one question, and then it's the chairman's intent to take perhaps a 5 to 10 minute recess and allow folks to chew this over with members of their own constituent groups and to talk amongst themselves, not in a dispository way, however, because we don't want to have meetings inside this meeting. But in general terms, the rest of the bill reflects the kinds of adjustments that we've made, discussed, and pulled from the report. Is there any comment you'd like to make on the non-numeric adjustments to the bill? Either one of you.
I would just comment, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that I think that legislative revenue staff did an admirable job of bringing forward the language as it was intended from the task force for those non-economic issues.
Okay. Mr. Marshall?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would focus briefly on the requirements for the interim task force. What you're doing is essentially setting up the same structure that existed in for the last year and a half. That proved to be for lack of a better term, an unwieldy process. And I would suggest that rather than trying to convene a full-fledged task force that comes with it, that carries with it certain fiscal requirements on the part of the Department of Education to staff it, that the language be drafted in a way that would require the state superintendent of public instruction to cause to have a study done, and that that study involve the resources, both the time, the people, and the money, of the Oregon Association of ESDs, bringing in the folks from both OSBA and COSA. It would seem to me that there's nobody that understands the services issue and the difficulty of providing services in a variety of environments in which ESDs exist than the ESDs themselves. And the organization of ESDs has a structure in place. They have zones in place. They have a membership structure that I think and I don't believe the legislature can direct what is essentially a private organization to conduct the study, but they can cause the state superintendent to cause that study to occur. I think it would be cheaper. It would certainly cause all the ESDs to come into a room, and it would seem to me that that would be a better way to get the result that we all want out of this, rather than going back and creating another task force, which most certainly the department would suggest would take one or two FTE and cost upwards of $250,000.
Mr. Marshall, there's certain justification for that kind of an approach. The only question I would have is, there are two. Why would the state superintendent not call this an unfunded mandate and demand $250,000 for the first question? The other question is, I agree that it would be highly beneficial to have that information brought forward by the ESDs themselves, but we did not have, I think you'll agree, a good broad-based representation geographically in the state and the other task force, and there was no legislative connection. So a lot of us began in this process having never heard the issues articulated before, and it's been a long, steep learning curve. So I guess I would argue that wherever we ask this work to be done, it'll generate some demand for resources, and there needs to be fair and reasonable geographic distribution of the folks that consider the question, and there should be some legislative connection.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would frankly argue that there was a legislative connection on the prior task force, and because of limited time, other responsibilities, and frankly, a lot of these meetings were pretty boring. Very frankly, the participation of those legislative appointees was less than stellar.
Mr. Chair.
Question, Senator Castillo.
I wanted to ask John's reaction to this other proposal about going a different direction. What do you think that the superintendents that you've been talking with, or the ESDs that you've been speaking with, how would they react to this other direction of trying to take into account, if you did a straight, across the board what you're suggesting, how some people would then end up below the median who are now above it, and how you would deal with that?
Senator Castillo, you're asking for the comparison between the 3% and the differential closure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Castillo, if I understand your question, you're asking how I view what I said versus what Mr. Campbell said.
Well, based on your discussions with the ESDs you've been speaking with.
I think that there are probably some ESDs that are at the top that would take that upwards of 3% reduction that believe that's too much. There are those ESDs below the mean that believe that that's not enough and it's not fast enough to move towards equalization. Again, you've got the extremes, and the folks at the top want to be protected. The folks at the bottom want immediate relief. Well, you're again dealing with a limited pot of money, and the question is how can we all come out of here saying that we've rationally dealt with this? We've looked at the high and we've brought them down a little bit. and some would suggest that a 3% is manageable. Others will argue perhaps that it's too great. On the other hand, folks will still look at the numbers based on that approach and say there's still a differential or a disparity that's it's not equitable, and we ought to be making progress faster. So, I mean, it's obvious. How do you balance out those interests? And we believe that a 3% reduction on the top, moving those dollars around to bring folks up, is a rational compromise. And that's been my role in trying to determine where that middle ground lies.
It's really starting to feel like Groundhog Day on this bill.
You mean you're just about ready to move it, Senator? Well, let me suggest something. This is an excellent opportunity to ask Mr. Marshall and Mr. Campbell to step out in the hallway, and whoever emerges from the conversation. No, actually, this I think this would be a good time for us to take 10 minutes. We'll leave off here at as soon as Senator
Maybe Meyer... neither of them would come back.
That's probably true. Senator Beyer, you had a question?
I just wondered about if we have a conflict between the whereas is the preamble of what we're trying to do, and the formula. The intent statement says we're intending to get full equity within 4 years, and the mathematics, and I'm not a math major, but the mathematics suggests to me that if you ran this formula out for 4 years, we wouldn't get there.
Yeah.
Senator, you're absolutely right. Let me end on, just a short statement of principle. And I'd like the committee to recess until 25 after, and then please don't wander away, because I'd like to get closure on this bill if we can today. It seems clear that we're going to need a little modification no matter what else we do, but this could, if we stay on task, be the last full hearing that we have on this bill before it's moved. The glide path is now for a full 4 years, but that means that... it really does not achieve the equity until the first year of the next biennium. So this 2% puts us on what you could reasonably call a 5-year glide path.
So do we get there in 5 years?
We actually get there in four. Well, it'd be 5 years. About the middle of the biennium in the next section, we get there. So that's what the 2% did. And it's not full equity. It's the target. It's the median that we're looking at.
So does that mean, and let me play that back, at the end, in the fifth year, if we continue this formula at 2%, all the districts would be getting the same ADM?
No. They would all, well, I'll let Steve answer that question since it's his formula.
Where do we get?
I lay no claim to it.
Right.
Because I've heard that under the 2%, we wouldn't get there for, like, even 10 years. If people were saying it would be a really long time before we would get to equity if we just did the 2%.
Well, that's not an answer.
Two comments. One, this only applies to 2001, 2003. Whether you get the equity after that, one, depends upon how much the appropriation might be in that year. Two, it depends upon whether changes are made to reduce the hold harmless districts. And three, how much of that gap is closed or not, and whether the funding, the appropriation for the funding, would be sufficient then to eliminate the gap.
So I think the thing that intervenes on this glide path is the question of service equity, the studies, and the recommendations that would come back. The point is the recommendations from the task force were for a 4-year equity, but the question of defining equity was not resolved. You know, whether it's a service equity or an ADMW equity is sort of two concepts that don't mesh well, especially when you hear the arguments from some of the smaller ESDs that they don't have access to some of the services, they don't have the depth on the bench per se. And so the question of equity, I think, needs to be considered in along with the financial consideration. So this is a step toward equity, and then it's a request for additional information to come back. There will be some anomalies, and until we get the questions of equity solved, there's every reason to try to protect the small and remote and the self-funded and the oddball, the anomalous antique formulas for equalization that we have in a couple of counties. So there's a lot of aspects here that will create anomalies. The only thing that we can be certain of is that when we come back into the legislative session, if we stay on this glide path, there's the opportunity to make those course corrections after we've got the service equity definitions. Mm-hmm. So I hope that helps solve the question. What we'll do, if there's no more questions from the panel, is we will recess until 9:30. And again, I would ask the committee members not to drift away if we could come back at 9:30.
What do you consider drifting, Mr. Chair?
being back in your chair at 9:30, Mr. Corcoran.
That's not bad. Question. We don't have to do any math problems or anything.
No, there is no homework for the next 10 minutes. So we are in recess till 9:30.